Thank you for joining us, the Spring of Sustainability program. It's a production of the Shift Network, the Sustainable World Coalition, and hosted this week by the Endangered Species Coalition. Our panel topic today is Vanishing Species in a Warming World. And we have three excellent speakers, all of whom are colleagues and friends of mine, and they will go in this order. First will be John Kostiak. John is Vice President of Wildlife Conservation for the National Wildlife Federation. His full biography, as well as the others, is on the website. So he's going to focus on local issues, for the most part, and disaster-related issues. Second will be Lori McDonald. Lori is the Florida Director of Defenders of Wildlife. She will focus mostly on state-related efforts to deal with this issue. And then last, but certainly not least, is Marjorie Mulhall. Marjorie is an attorney with Earth Justice, and she will focus predominantly on the federal response of federal endangered species and the impact of climate change on the Endangered Species Act. And so with no further ado, I would like to pass it over to John Kostiak. People in the audience, as you're listening to these speakers, you should be thinking of questions you might want to ask after the presentations are done, and I'll give you instructions on how to ask those questions when we are at that point. So, John, thank you for joining us, and you can lead us off.
Thank you, Bill, and good afternoon, everyone. I'm really looking forward to this conversation. So we're here to talk about climate change, and I know you've all been hearing a lot about climate change. It's a planetary challenge, and we need to head off massive heat waves, floods, droughts, species extinctions, food shortages, a wide array of impacts. And that requires us to address sources of carbon pollution from all across the globe. So if we hope to save the Puget Sound coho salmon or the pika or the many other plant and animal species that are at risk of extinction due to climate change, we need to be thinking about carbon pollution from a coal plant in China just as much as we think about pollution from U.S. sources. That kind of interdependency has created a sense of helplessness on the part of a lot of people, and it's given the politicians an excuse to do nothing. I'm sure you've all heard the line, the U.S. really should not make any sacrifices to our quality of life until China and India have made the first move in cutting their carbon pollution. And that kind of frame, to me, is really troublesome. My challenge to you on the call today is let's work together to end that sense of helplessness and end those excuses. More and more, when we talk to our family and friends, and we talk to our political and our corporate leaders, we need to enlist them to join in the crusade to make a more livable planet. And many of them will only do that when they understand that it is in their self-interest. So the key for us to persuade them, and as quickly as possible with our words and our deeds, is to get our own house in order on climate change and show that that work improves our quality of life, strengthens our local economy, helps us. So I'd like to ask each of you to think about what you value most about your life, where you live. And I'm going to guess that you value quality time with your friends and family, a safe place to live, beautiful surroundings, healthy air, water, and food. So my takeaway is take action locally to address climate change, help all of those aspects of quality of life for you and your community. And it will help our political leaders see that bold steps on the national and international stage is something that we want and we need. So the old adage about thinking globally and acting locally rings true. I think it rings truer today than ever. So what kind of local action am I talking about? Well, the best kind of action that helps you and your community is one that reduces the pollution that causes climate change, what we sometimes call mitigation action, and reduces the impacts of carbon pollution, impacts of climate change, and we sometimes call that adaptation. Two examples. Take a look at your own backyard, or if you don't have a backyard, take a look at your nearest community open space. If that place is overrun with invasive plants or covered with a manicured lawn, you can be involved right now in restoring with native grasses and shrubs. Those native grasses and shrubs will be far less demanding of the artificial fertilizers and pesticides, products that have a high carbon footprint, major source of polluted runoff. And they'll be much more likely to provide food and cover for native wildlife. So with that one small action, you can help cut carbon pollution and help wildlife and streams adapt to climate change and make your surroundings more beautiful and more attractive places to live. So if you want more on that, National Wildlife Federation has a good program called Backyard Wildlife Habitat or Community Wildlife Habitat. go to our website at nwf.org and check that out. Second example I want to give you, and then I'm going to close and look forward to hearing the other speakers, is when we act locally on climate, oftentimes it's best to do it as part of an organization. It may be much more effective. So look around your community to see which organizations are focused on local sustainability. In virtually every city and town, some NGO, and oftentimes a public agency, is leading an effort to make the community environmentally sustainable. Today, sustainability includes the idea of becoming climate smart and how we build our community and update our community infrastructure. I'm talking about energy infrastructure, water, transportation. One that I've been really focused on in my work is water infrastructure. We need right now, because of climate change, to get communities to adopt better stormwater management, stormwater protection strategies. And, you know, think about Hurricane Katrina and Superstorm Sandy, how much of that devastation could have been avoided if we had thought, been more thoughtful, better understanding what is coming in terms of climate change and preparing for it. So, fortunately, community leaders are becoming increasingly aware of the storms and floods that accompany climate change. There's all kinds of exciting work that's already underway to protect and restore natural features of the land in the name of flood protection, features such as wetlands, floodplains, coastal dunes, oyster reefs, and the like. These places provide a huge array of benefits for local communities. They buffer people and property from the intensified storms and floods. They sequester carbon in our natural systems. They provide critical fish and wildlife habitat. They create that community open space for recreation, for overall quality of life. So we've been working on a program called Climate Smart Communities, and go to our website and check it out for some ideas. There's plenty of other people working in this space as well. A huge opportunity to make a difference on climate change and to help wildlife. So I'm just going to wrap up and say, let's flip the narrative. Solving climate change is not about making sacrifices. It's all about the need to act at a local level. So let's show that acting on climate is all about building better and safer places to live and work and play, and protecting and restoring wildlife habitat. We take these actions, and then we should go out and let everybody know you're part of the climate change solution. I'm all set. I'm ready for the next one.
John, that was excellent. Thank you so much. And remember, for those who may have joined late, you will have opportunities to ask questions after all three speakers are finished. And now we're going to go to our second speaker. We're sort of working our way up the governmental chain. We're going to now go from the local government, which John just talked about. We're now going to talk about state governments. And Lori McDonald, take it away.
Thanks so much, Bill. I'm going to speak about states, and in particular, I think I'm on this panel because I live in a state that is one of the areas that is at most risk of climate change harmful impacts in the world, actually. In fact, while we're talking about vanishing species today, you might call Florida a vanishing state. And as I talk about the attributes and the examples here, you may find that in your region, your state, your province, that you also have some of these conditions in the area where you are. Florida is among the most vulnerable regions in the world, not only to the impacts of climate change, but in particular to sea level rise. Sea level rise will cause the submersion of the very famous, much of the very famous Florida Keys and the southern tip of Florida, where the Everglades and the Big Cypress systems are, which are, in fact, United Nations World Heritage Sites. This also means submersion of parts of, like, the Miami metropolitan area. In fact, many of the national wildlife refuges that are in Florida are along the coastline. Florida is vulnerable because of its low topography. That is, it's a flat state. And because of the extensive coastline, it has the longest coastline in the United States, of any of the states except Alaska, which is also another very vulnerable region. And also because of the increasing intensity of storm events, including hurricanes, which we're seeing fall not just in this area, the Gulf of Mexico and so forth, but going unusually up the coast into New England in recent years. Florida is situated at the meeting point of temperate and tropical zones, jutting out into the ocean but anchored in the American continent. It's a hotspot of biodiversity with many hundreds of vertebrate species, thousands of invertebrates, and many of these are endemics, species that are found only here. So when you think about in your region, species that are not found anywhere else in the world, you might consider that those are especially probably at risk. This state of Florida has lost many species already to extinction or extirpation, and currently has 130 on the list of federal and state endangered species. The things that have happened in the past that have caused like losses, the losses and fragmentation of habitat, over-exploitation, invasive species competition, other factors, these have already weakened or decreased the abundance and diversity of many wildlife species. But with climate change, we are layering on such an important and incredible force to deal with. As my colleagues talk about the impacts of climate change, I'm going to go further with some examples. And one of the best examples is sea turtles, most of which are already designated as endangered species. We're seeing some recovery, though, which is really great to hear. But now we have climate change, which, in fact, is already affecting some of the sea turtle species. The coastline of Florida provides globally important sea turtle nesting beaches. And yet a study by Reese and others projects up to a 43% decrease in beach area based on a possible 0.5 meter of sea level rise. And 0.5 meter is a pretty conservative estimate. And you couple this loss of beaches by the attempt of many people to armor the beaches and coastline in front of their homes or hotels with seawalls and other mechanisms, this further cuts off available nesting sites for sea turtles. Even the northward movement possible for some of these populations, in that we encounter the problem that our land protection efforts in the past may not have targeted areas that will be needed. Altogether, some poor land use practices today, and which might increase as people try to prevent climate change and sea level rise and so forth from happening, these can exacerbate the existing conditions. Let me add to this some additional important phenomena that show the interplay of climate change to wildlife, again using sea turtles as an illustration. These are behavioral and physiological responses to climate change. For one thing, there has shown to be a continuing trend for sea turtles to choose to nest earlier than in the past. The implications of this are not yet known. There's much that's not yet known about what will happen, how to predict what changes will be, and how to adapt to them. But another important physiological impact occurs with respect to sea turtle gender, that is, whether or not the embryo will develop into a male or a female. It's determined by the temperature around the eggs that lie in the nest under the sand. Higher temperatures in turtle nests are already leading to changes in sex ratios such that there are fewer males. And scientists are debating the number of males needed to maintain healthy populations and whether change will come too fast for this ancient species to adapt. Here's some other examples of impacts. The Florida panther, estimated at less than 200 animals, a critically endangered species, but showing some good progress in the recent decade or so, is very habitat limited in South Florida. But that habitat, much of the southern end of the peninsula, is going to be inundated with water. And there will be also saltwater intrusion from underground groundwater. People will be trying to move inland. This is going to make a huge difference for the Florida panther. It may, in fact, compel all of us, including the Fish and Wildlife Service, to work without any haste in establishing the second and third populations in panther's historic habitat in the southeastern United States. The manatee is another species that may maybe have some northward movement, but its habitat has also put at further risk from the loss of warm water springs and coastal refuges, cold stress in a very fluctuating weather pattern, and very importantly, increased red tide, algal blooms. They, in fact, have resulted in this past year having the largest die-off of manatees ever recorded. I'm probably running out of time here, but I have several other examples which maybe we'll bring up, in particular about the Florida Keys and a great deal of submersion of that chain of really unique and fascinating keys and the wildlife on them. We need to protect healthy communities overall. We need to protect many representative samples, I guess you'd say, or areas of different kinds of habitat. We need to connect them and be sure that there's health and resilience so that they can adapt. On a state level, And I'm speaking primarily here about state action, and I know that individuals can make a difference in state policy and how state policy is implemented. If you have a chance to cast a vote for conservation measures, do so. Here in this state, we have a historic vote coming up on a constitutional amendment to fund land and water protection and wildlife habitat. All state plans, especially wildlife plans, land use plans, should be addressing climate change and interagency planning and public education and involvement. So think about connectivity. Think about how to incorporate these things into local, state, and national planning. Thank you very much.
Lori, thank you. Thank you so much, Lori. And for those I can see on the computer that we've had a few late additions to the call. We were led off by John Kostiak, who focused predominantly on local responses to climate change. Lori McDonald just spoke about state responses, although if you've been listening carefully, you can hear the intersection of all governmental levels. And now we're going to, our third and final speaker is going to be Marjorie Mulhall, who is going to focus predominantly on the federal response and the federal opportunities. Marjorie, your turn.
Thanks, Bill. Well, great to be speaking with you all today. I'm looking forward to chatting after I go through some opening remarks here. I wanted to talk today about climate change and wildlife at the federal level, as Bill said, really through the lens of the U.S. Endangered Species Act. That's the law that I focus on in my work here at Earth Justice. The Endangered Species Act was passed with nearly unanimous bipartisan support just over 40 years ago, back in 1973. And this law is widely considered the strongest endangered species protection legislation ever enacted by any country. And the Endangered Species Act has been incredibly effective in protecting the species from extinctions, preventing the extinctions of hundreds of species. However, climate change increasingly poses huge challenges for wildlife the world over, as John and Lori have been discussing. And the ESA is an incredibly flexible act, and if funded adequately and equipped with administrative policies that contemplate climate change-based threats, the ESA can definitely remain a great tool to protect biodiversity, even in our changing climate. Unfortunately, though, right at this time when we really need the ESA more than ever, we've seen some very troubling attacks on the Endangered Species Act by some members of Congress. As an example, just within the past month, a number of bills to undermine the Endangered Species Act have started making their way through the House of Representatives. And this and other similar bills that we've been seeing in this Congress and past Congresses absolutely must be defeated if we are to have a hope of adequately protecting species in our changing climate. We must maintain a strong Endangered Species Act, which is really our nation's safety net to protect species on the brink of extinction. I want to, and I'll talk here in a second about how you all on the line here can help do that. I just wanted to quickly turn to a couple of examples of species that have already received protections under the Endangered Species Act, either largely or entirely because of climate-based threats. One of those is the polar bear, probably the best-known example of a species that's really going to have a hard time, is already having a hard time in a warming world. Polar bears depend on sea ice for hunting. They also travel and mate and sometimes even give birth on sea ice. And because of rapid warming in the Arctic, where polar bears live, and the loss of the sea ice, back in 2008, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service listed the polar bear under the Endangered Species Act. At the time of that listing, then Secretary of the Interior Kemp Thorne stated that such a listing was not meant to sort of pull the ESA into the role of regulating greenhouse gas emissions, which are causing climate change. He said that such regulation of, you know, power plants and cars and other things like that in terms of greenhouse gas emissions would be an improper use of the ESA. And here we are 6 years later since the listing of the polar bear, without still any, you know, adequate national or really global response to attack the cause of the polar bear's imperilment head on. So I'm hoping we can chat about that a bit more and the need for climate action when we get to the questions and discussion. Another quick example of a species imperiled in a warming world is the wolverine. Wolverines are, stocky, sort of, they animals. They resemble bears. They're known to be kind of loners, and they have vast ranges, including alpine areas, and they very much depend on snowpack, adequate snowpack, particularly for denning and raising, you know, rearing their young. Because of warming temperatures and the loss of snowpack, in 2013, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service proposed listing the lower 48 states wolverine under the Endangered Species Act. And unfortunately, that listing is not yet finalized, but yet provides another example of species receiving listings largely due to climate threats. And lastly, the last example I want to give is an interesting one because it sort of highlights the interplay between impacts to species in a warming world. And this is the example of the Yellowstone grizzly bear. A number of years ago, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service proposed to actually remove federal protections for Yellowstone grizzly bears. A number of environmental groups, including my own, challenged that, citing that the whitebark pine tree, which is the nuts of which is a key food source for Yellowstone grizzly bears, was really is really getting impacted a lot by mountain pine beetles that in the past were killed off by cold winters, but no longer now that we are in a warming world here. So we argued to a court successfully that Yellowstone grizzly bears should not lose federal protections just yet, that the agency needed to go back and really examine the impact of the loss of whitebark pine trees because of climate change on Yellowstone grizzly bears going forward. And so that saga of federal protections for Yellowstone grizzly bears continues, but yet serves as another example. So those are some stories of, you know, the Endangered Species Act operating in a changing climate. And, you know, as I've been indicating, the ESA alone certainly cannot solve our climate problems, cannot adequately address threats to species. And that's definitely going to take actual significant steps to reduce greenhouse gases at the federal and global level. So hopefully we can discuss that a bit more as our chat here goes on. But in terms of, you know, what folks on the call can do to really help at the federal level for protecting species in a warming world, reaching out to your members of Congress to highlight that you care about the Endangered Species Act, want it to remain strong and intact, that would be a huge, huge help in protecting species in a warming world. And you can go to the Earth Justice website or the websites of virtually any of our ESA partners, the Endangered Species Coalition and others, to sign action alerts to your members of Congress on the need for a strong ESA. And I think I'll leave it there.
Thank you, Marjorie. Well, I'm looking at the computer. We have lots of people either on the phone or online, and that is wonderful. Let me just remind you that now it is your turn. You can ask a question either by pressing 1 on your phone, and you will be able to ask your question, or by writing a question online if you are participating online. One reminder, as people are pondering their questions, that the whole reason the Endangered Species Coalition is partnering with the Spring of Sustainability folks this week is that this Friday is Endangered Species Day. Marjorie was just talking about the Endangered Species Act, and the Endangered Species Coalition, which all of us participate in on some level or another, has been sponsoring, along with the United States Congress, Endangered Species Day. And you can get more information on Endangered Species Day by logging on to, you might guess it, endangeredspeciesday.org. And all sorts of information about what you can do this Friday will be available to you. So I'll get the questions rolling, and I'm going to ask a generic question to all three of our speakers. And if you could limit your answer to 1 minute or less as the callers think about their questions. My generic question to all three of you is this. John spoke about the local efforts predominantly, Lori the state, Marjorie the federal, but all three of you also talked about the other levels of government in your presentation. Is there a success story that leaps out to you, or perhaps on the other side of the equation, a glaring omission on how governments at different levels in our country are either cooperating and communicating or not cooperating and communicating. It seems to me that federal agencies need to talk to each other. Federal agencies need to talk to state and local agencies. Could each of you take a minute or less and flesh that issue of intergovernmental cooperation out a little bit more for our listeners? John, you can start.
Well, I do think there is a lot of successes out there we should acknowledge. And I guess the one that I would highlight is there really is a consensus in this country about spending taxpayer money for wildlife habitat. We hear all this noise about the need to cut government spending and fight deficits and that sort of thing. But every single time there's a square up and down vote, either directly put to voters through ballot measures or put on the floor of Congress or in the state legislatures, and it's focused on protecting land or water for the benefit of people and wildlife, I wouldn't say every time, but pretty close to 100% success ratio. We just have one success after another to look at. And if you want to see one good website that captures some of this work, is at landvote.org. But I just think sometimes we forget that we are winning, at least in certain venues, and that most politicians understand that there is this deep, abiding love for wildlife and for the land and for clean water among the American people. And so we have a very strong hand to start with, and we have a long track record of success to build on.
Thank you, John. Lori?
Well, one of the examples I can think of is that in the northwest part of Florida, the Panhandle, there's a vision for establishing a cross-Florida wildlife habitat network, and it would involve private landowner easements for conservation. It would involve state funding of the land acquisition and easement program. It involves Department of Defense lands, because the Air Force base is there is the largest, I guess you'd say, forested military facility in the United States, if not the world, and reaches from the coast inland to the forest and through rivers. And so I think that's a great example of where there's a lot of, can be a great interagency and public-private work.
Thank you, Lori. Marjorie?
Yeah, it's a great question, Bill. I'll just highlight, since I spoke on the Endangered Species Act, that actually that very law has built into it the plan of states and the federal agencies working together to conserve imperiled species. Section 6 of the Act contemplates that explicitly. And so as a result, under the Endangered Species Act, states and federal agencies have worked together, done a variety of cooperative conservation partnerships and agreements. One that comes to mind is research on humpback whales in Maine. Researchers at the state level working with federal agencies to further the knowledge about those whales, and that's just one among many, many such cooperative agreements worked out under the ESA.
Thank you so much, Marjorie. Well, the questions are now coming in from the audience, and so let me give you the first one from Andrew, who asks, what was the natural rate of extinction before humans each year? What is the rate now, and how much is human-made? He also goes on to ask, how does the U.S. compare to the rest of the world? And I'm going to add a little addition to this, how much of the extinction rate we're now experiencing might be related to global warming. So it's a lot of questions, but all relating to natural rates of extinction, rates of extinction now, and climate change and global warming's impact on that. Who of the three of you wants to take a crack at that question?
This is John. I'm happy to try and then encourage my colleagues to backfill. I'll go real fast. I'm not going to give exact numbers. They're not right at my fingertips. But we do know, based on the historical record, on the fossil record, that extinctions happen in bursts. There are large extinction events of extremely rare. You know, there's been five, and not counting the one we're in right now,
before the arrival of humans. And then most of the rest of the extinctions have been at a very slow pace, a handful per year. And so it's hard, therefore, to compare today's rate, what are we comparing it with. The leading conservation biologists say we are essentially creating extinctions now that rival those mass extinctions of the past, that we are thousands of times in excess of the background rate. And so that's obviously very worrisome. And the IPCC, the leading authoritative body on climate change, says that climate change is under some of the mid to upper scenarios of climate change, continuing business as usual, would lead to extinction of over a third of the species on the planet. And those IPCC reports, unfortunately, to date have been overly conservative. They don't take into account some of the dramatic things that have happened just in the past few years, such as this week's news about the collapse of the West Antarctic glaciers. So bottom line is we need to fight climate change if we hope to get a grip on extinction. There's a bunch of other drivers we need to address at once. It's a massive challenge.
Very good. Marjorie or Lori, anything to add to that answer, that excellent answer?
Nothing to add.
Well, it's my understanding also that scientists estimate that we're losing species at about from 1,000 to 10,000 times the background rate. And I think one thing that's both interesting in an analytical sense and also really quite eye-opening is that the so-called natural communities of the future are not necessarily going to look the same, of course, as we have today. The communities today do have extinctions. There is a background rate. There is speciation going on. And it's always evolving, but there may be whole different assemblages and interdependencies than we have now. So the old way of looking at things needs to be new.
Thank you so much, Lori. Remember, if you want to ask a question, you can hit the one pad on your phone, or you can also type questions in online. I don't see any hands up right now. We lost a hand caller in the 415 area code, so I'll ask one more question, and I'll direct this one at Lori. Lori, you spoke a lot about Florida, and understandably, that's where you're from, and Florida is one of the states that could be seriously and heavily impacted by climate change. California, as I think many know, has also been dealing with climate change, and the state governments has a pretty sophisticated climate response regime. Besides those two states, though, so I'm taking California off just for the time being. We can come back to California. Are there other states that are doing things that you think are positive, maybe in the Northeast, maybe in the Southwest? Can you give us an example outside of Florida where things are happening that might educate folks on the line about what good can be done?
Well, there's just a little bit I can say about that, and I bring this back a lot to the state wildlife action plans that each state wrote back in 2008 and are doing updates on periodically through the federal legislation. If they wrote an acceptable state wildlife action plan, they could get grants back to the state through that federal program. And those action plans are, again, in the process of being revised and updated. Every one of those should have climate change integrated into their work and into their actions. I recall the state of Missouri having a very fine one. I recall, yes, California had a fine one. I think Oregon did. And I think that's a great fundamental place to start to be if a state hasn't already, to be sure their action plans are updated and integrated climate change.
Thank you so much, Lori. And I happen to know, this is Bill Snape, the moderator, that the Georgetown University Law Center has a state climate program, and I don't have the website in front of me, but for those that are interested in the state issue, there's a lot of websites out there, but the Georgetown Law Center State Climate Center has a lot of good information on what various states are doing. So I am testing this technology. We have a caller from the 415 area code who's going to give us a question over the phone. I think.
Can you hear me?
We sure can. give us your name and then give us your question. Thanks for joining.
Sure. This is Vineet Allen in the San Francisco Bay Area. I know there's been some back and forth in terms of whether the EPA has the authority to regulate CO2 emissions, and what is the current status of that, and how far can they go with that? I mean, it seems like if they were given full authority to do that, that might, you know, be the answer, or at least one of the primary answers in terms of a federal response and the U.S. doing its part for the largest GHG emission of CO2. So where do we stand with that?
That's a great question. Who wants to give that one a crack?
Oh, this is John. I'm happy to take a crack at it. So it's actually very clear that EPA has the authority under the Clean Air Act to regulate point sources of pollution, including carbon pollution. Its findings about how carbon pollution is one of those pollutants that endangers the public health and safety and welfare was a reasonable finding, been upheld by the Supreme Court in the famous case of Massachusetts versus EPA. And so it has a lot of room to regulate global warming pollution, at least from point sources. You can assume that every single rulemaking, including the ones that are coming on power plants, will be challenged in court over the details, though the fundamental authority to regulate really can't be challenged anymore. The details of how they regulate will be litigated. So that is one of the challenges of doing a lot of this directly through EPA rulemakings. And the other big challenge is we have a lot of aspects of climate change that are not subject to the Clean Air Act. You know, we have massive emissions, for example, from deforestation, and the list goes on. And so there's been a lot of push, including from my organization, to get more comprehensive approaches through legislation, which obviously we have some work to do on getting the politics right, but getting a price on all carbon pollution is really the way to go. There's some kind of carbon tax or some kind of fee that would complement what EPA is doing for the Clean Air Act.
Thank you, John. Lori or Marjorie, do you want to add to that? I have another question. No pressure if you don't want to add on.
This is Marjorie. I just wanted to chime in and say that I believe the EPA is set to propose a rule to limit carbon pollution from existing power plants by June 1st of this year. So it's a very timely question that our caller had. And so another way to sort of get involved, I would say, would be to weigh in with a comment to the EPA in support of that rule when it comes out. And I know my organization and many others are going to be organizing our activists to weigh in with the EPA in support of that latest carbon pollution rule under the Clean Air Act.
That's a good point, Marjorie, and I'll add only, this is Bill Snape, that there's an existing proposed rule out for new power plants as well. So EPA is looking both at new power plants and existing power plants and trying to get a handle on that pollution. That's a very good point. I have a question from Lisa via the web, and she asks, with the melting ice caps and species loss as a result, how might that affect other species around the world? In other words, the global interdependency of species that it's often challenging to see and understand. Anyone want to give that question a answer?
Just briefly, I will, Lori. This is a really important dynamic which we need to understand more about. As one species is lost, or as one species is lost from a community by perhaps moving or relocating to a different area, because there is such interdependence of, you know, predator-prey relationships or foraging of one species and dependent on another and so forth, it can have the loss of one can have repercussions reverberate throughout the system.
Barry, thank you very much. Yeah,
brief additional point I would make is, since you alluded to the melting polar ice caps, obviously when you lose ice off of the land, such as Greenland or Antarctica, that accelerates sea level rise, and a huge percentage of the planet's biodiversity and food supply is right on the coast. So as those coastal wetlands that are the nurseries for our fish and wildlife get swamped by sea level rise, we have a lot of work to do to make sure that there's opportunities to create new habitats further inland as well. And but that, if you need additional motivation to work on fighting climate change, just think about the loss of those ice sheets and what it means for our coasts.
Yeah, thank you for both those answers. I'll just point out that just within the last week, there's been a recent study that a huge chunk of Antarctica is melting at a far faster rate than we previously thought, just underscoring what Lori and John just explained to us. Well, I think this might be our last question, but we'll give each of the speakers a minute or so to wrap up. Sally asks, John mentioned local ways to address climate change. What is the best way for residents of a town to engage or get their town engaged in mitigation or adaptation? We'll start with John, but Lori and Marjorie can chime in as well.
Well, I already alluded in my opening to the need to work on flood protection, because that's a great way to get multiple wins by essentially planting and restoring and protecting those wetlands and floodplains in your community, because that's going to help buffer floods as well as help wildlife adapt to climate change. So I guess the additional one I would put on the table is to think seriously about your energy systems. There's enormous opportunities to cut your city's carbon footprint by installing energy efficiency and renewable energy systems. The cost of them are coming down every single day. And by the way, the working on energy isn't just about using high tech. A lot of the energy solutions are about replanting the urban forests. So get involved in thinking about how you can help your community reduce its air conditioning costs by replanting the urban forests, as well as getting wind and solar energy efficiency installed. I think that's one of the things you can do at the local level that's going to have the biggest impact.
Thank you, John. Lori or Marjorie?
This is Lori. I think that it's really important to speak with neighbors and family and friends and just bring these matters up in conversation in an easy way, and to speak definitely with decision makers. They need to hear from people. Again, it doesn't have to be like in your face, you got to believe like I believe and force solutions on them, but working with them to find ways that people can incorporate change, and that decision makers at the city councils, at state legislatures and assemblies, and at our national level in Congress hear from you and know that you care about it and know that you believe a difference can be made and that they need to be making that difference themselves.
Well, we are getting close to the end here, and I want to point out to our audience that has been incredibly engaged, the questions have been flying fast and furious, that the two topics that we just lost track of time, we just couldn't get to, but that I think will continue, you'll continue to hear things about, are the natural gas boom in this country that is relevant to combating climate change, and then also how and where to place renewable energy operations. There are a lot of win-win solutions out there that I know all three of our panelists have worked on, but the key obviously is to make sure that solar and wind and other installations are not only installed, but installed in a way that is environmentally friendly, and there are ways to do that. We just didn't get a chance to talk about those two issues, but they are obviously important issues. Well, we are about to wrap up. Again, this Friday is Endangered Species Day. Go to endangeredspeciesday.org. And now I'm going to let each of the three excellent panelists get about a minute or so and wrap up with what they think about this session and most importantly, what you can do to combat the scourge of climate change. And we'll go the same order we started with. We'll start with John, then Lori, then Marjorie.
Thanks, Phil, and thanks to everybody who joined us today. This has been a good conversation. I hope you're getting a lot out of it. I guess I'll close just to pick up on the last point that Bill made by saying we're really in a new era of conservation. Maybe there was a time where we had to have the luxury of just going out there and fighting for that last great place and protecting open space, which obviously remains important. But today, the work of wildlife conservation really requires us to be in favor of something. Favor of various kinds of human development in order to save wildlife. And that's a new frame, very challenging for us to integrate into our everyday work. We need to be out there thinking about what the new developments that are going to be like after the big storms roll through, which are inevitable. We need to be thinking about how we can support clean energy as opposed to just blocking the bad energy projects. And so I would really encourage everybody to think about how they can be part of the climate change solution and to promote solutions that are good for wildlife in the short term, but also reduces our carbon footprint, so wildlife has a real shot in the long term.
Thank you, John. Lori?
I think that's wonderful, and I simply want to say that this is a really wondrous world, and we want generations, not just of people, but generations of wildlife to be able to continue and live their lives. And so thank you so much for taking part today, for listening in, and I think you probably already are a pretty active person having taken part in this. So thank you for what you do, and carry on the message. Thanks.
And Marjorie, you get the last word.
I just wanted to echo the thanks to everyone who's on the call today. It's been great to have the chance to chat about these issues together and with you all. And just wanted to reiterate sort of the ask that I'd put forward earlier in the call, which is the importance of really protecting the Endangered Species Act, which is which alone certainly cannot solve our climate crisis, but is a huge part of helping protect the species that will be most impacted and are being most impacted by a change in climate. So a reminder to please jump on either the Endangered Species Coalition website or Earth Justice website or any major organization's website to weigh in with your decision makers about the importance of maintaining the Endangered Species Act. And thank you all again so much for being on the call today.
Thank you, Margie. Well, we're almost near the end, but don't hang up yet. We have a few extra items, bonus items for you. First of all, Bob from Idaho just wrote on the web, don't forget about public lands. We have to stop fossil fuel extraction on public lands. And I promised Bob that I would, from Idaho, that I would throw that out. Sorry that we couldn't get to his question. Well, John, Lori, and Marjorie, thank you so much. Excellent panel. Be sure to join us for the next endangered species session with the sustainability program tomorrow, May 15th. Noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, when the speakers from Oceana, the Pew Charitable Trust, and the Endangered Species Coalition, along with Chef Nora Pleon, who will deepen our understanding of what is happening to species in our oceans and what we can do to protect them. On Friday, Endangered Species Day itself, there will be a special reading of Dr. Seuss's The Lorax by actor, director, and environmentalist Ed Begley, Jr. So continue to stay connected through the entire series. The Spring of Sustainability, folks, thank you so much. Thanks for listening, and we hope to talk to you soon. Bye-bye.